Oh, you are good.
Well, your wife said the same thing.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Kent Conrad.
And I'm Chuck Grassley.
This week, President Barack Obama made the first overseas trip of his presidency, and there in London, big news.
Well, the big news was that he gave the Queen of England an iPod filled with It's All Politics podcasts.
Which is a little known and underreported fact.
Exactly.
But he was immediately upstaged by his wife, Michelle Obama, who
put her arm around Her Majesty.
Yes, around her shoulder.
The Queen of England.
Which I understand prompted an official response from the reigning monarch of Great Britain and all the Commonwealth. She put her arm around Michelle Obama's
This sounds
waist.
Like the Profumo scandal.
Well, the Brits are not taking this very well. Plus, they were also offended by President Obama's repeated reference to England.
Right.
Now, they were in England.
Right.
But you have to be diplomatic and refer to Britain.
Right.
So that you include the Scots, the Welsh, and the Northern Irish.
Right. And they were also upset when John McCain talked about the 13 colonies.
The official word on this from Buckingham Palace is that there was no official breach of protocol.
Oh.
And I was glad to hear that, too, because it was a first date. Bringing the news back to Washington, Ken, if Michelle Obama can grab her, why can't Eric Holder?
What's happening with the Justice Department?
Eric Holder, the new Attorney General, is asking the trial judge to throw out the verdict against Ted Stevens. I think there's every indication that this has already been discussed with the judge, and the judge has every intention of throwing it out. The person at the heart of this entire controversy is a woman by the name of Brenda Morris, and her name is almost never mentioned.
Right. Who is she?
She is the lead prosecutor who was responsible for this prosecution and who was being regularly criticized in the courtroom by the judge, prompting all kinds of protests from the defense attorneys all through the trial last year, which began last summer, and eventually brought his conviction. And that contributed, I think it's hard to say it didn't make a crucial contribution to his defeat in November.
Oh, there's no question. He was convicted right before the election.
I thought the trial was going so badly for the prosecution, partly because of these constant admonishments from the judge, from Judge
Sullivan. The witnesses who would disappear, the kind of information that
FBI
the prosecution would not share.
Exactly. And the main issue really was, as you say, the non-sharing of potentially useful information to the defense. All of that almost made it look like he was going to be exonerated and then reelected in triumph in November. But he got on the stand. His wife got on the stand. Those exchanges with
unconvincing,
the prosecutor
very unconvincing
were
testimony.
Very damaging. And so in the end, Brenda Morris won a conviction.
And he lost by several hundred votes, which is not only the closest race in Alaska history, but given the fact that he was not only indicted but convicted and yet barely lost, showed the reservoir of great affection people in Alaska had. And it's so interesting that it was the Bush Justice Department. Now, I know these are more non-political people who ran the trial.
Well, they certainly weren't big Bush appointees.
Right.
This isn't something you could lay at the feet of Alberto Gonzalez, as much as some would like to.
Like the U.S. attorney scandal or something like that.
Or even at the feet of Gonzalez's successor, Mike Mukasey, who really didn't have much to do with this. But for the case to blow up like this and to blow back on the Justice Department in this fashion is truly stunning.
I don't think anybody is saying that Ted Stevens had no involvement in the shenanigans that were going on in Alaska. I think that Bill Allen, the contractor friend who did all this work on Ted Stevens' house, it really happened. I don't think anybody's questioning that. I think everybody's questioning the prosecution's approach to the case. But what happened? I mean, the famous Ray Donovan quote, "Where do I go to get my reputation back?" What is the legacy of Ted Stevens now?
Ray Donovan, of course, was the Labor Secretary
under
in
Reagan.
The first Ronald Reagan administration.
Right. Somebody else in the news from Alaska, the governor of Alaska was in the news this
her
week.
Name is, wait.
McCain's running mate. Former mayor of Wasilla.
But no, I saw her on television at one point. She was on with Katie Couric.
Defeated Frank Murkowski.
Well,
anyway, Sarah Palin is her name, by the way.
Sarah. Sarah with an H?
No, that would be Hera.
Okay.
Yeah. She had been invited to be the dinner speaker at the National Republican Senatorial and Congressional Committee in June
in Washington. A major fundraiser, multi-million dollar fundraiser, huge, huge venue.
And she was invited, and the question is, did she accept?
Well, depends on whom you ask.
Exactly.
If you ask one of her staffs, yes, she did. If you ask one of her other staffs, no.
And that's what's so bizarre about this whole thing, because everybody's talking about one of the things that came out of the 2008 elections was that, well, John McCain may not have been the darling of the conservatives, but Sarah Palin certainly was. And
she
was. Lots of talk about 2012.
Lots of talk.
But it's very interesting to see who is running the show, the Sarah Palin show.
No one is running the Sarah Palin show.
Or several people are, and they're not talking to each other.
I would say that this is a fascination point, though, for the media. We love to have a certain number of characters who, while they may not really be all that important to what's going on in national politics at a particular moment. I mean, she doesn't really have a national office. She's not a federal official. But she's fascinating. She is much more interesting than most of the people in Washington.
But in a Republican Party devoid of big
personalities,
big-time leaders.
That doesn't like the people they have in Washington.
Exactly.
They look away from Washington, right. D.C.
So anyway, she suddenly realized that they have budgetary problems in Juneau. And so she had begged off, and so now they have Newt Gingrich, who is an up-and-coming, what?
2012 prospect. I tell you what he is. He's an up-and-coming Catholic. He just converted Catholicism this past week, the religion of his third wife.
So all this, I think this whole incident seems to indicate is that nobody seems to be in charge of Sarah Palin 2012.
Somebody else who's got 2012 problems on the Republican side is our good old friend Tim Pawlenty,
yes.
The governor of Minnesota. And his problem really is in no sense of his own making. It is entirely the closeness of the 2008 Senate election in his home state.
Well, in fairness, I mean, it's not that Al Franken badly defeated Norm Coleman. It was an even race.
If he did defeat him, it was badly done. You yes. should do it by at least 1,000 votes. Well, just a personal thing. Just a personal standard. Get 1,000 votes.
I'll tell Scott Murphy that in New York 20.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
We'll get to that in a second. But Al Franken still has a 225-vote lead. But the big news of last week is that the 3-judge panel...
They narrowed it.
Right, Norm Coleman...
It's down to a 1.6-judge panel.
Norm Coleman wanted first 1,700 votes and 1,100 previously rejected absentee ballots to be considered by this panel. And now the panel says that on April 7th, they will only look at up to 400 votes, which that means that...
It's almost impossible mathematics.
Coleman needs 80% of that number to overturn the 225. Ben Ginsburg, who is a legal advisor to Norm Coleman, has already said that basically what the 3-judge panel has done is disenfranchised many Minnesota voters, and they're already going to the state Supreme Court, and that may not even be the end of it.
No, I think they'll probably go to the state Supreme Court. That'll go into May. And then the question becomes, will the national Republicans want to pony up some money to go to a federal court and ask for the Minnesota election to be essentially set aside?
And or the U.S. Supreme Court, if that doesn't happen. And this is all, a lot of it is being pushed by John Cornyn, the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee in Washington, who desperately wants to keep Al Franken from being the 59th Democratic vote in the Senate.
That's right. So they're prepared to have Minnesota go for not an indefinite period of time with just one senator. And that's where the problem comes.
For Tim Pawlenty.
Yes, because he is the symbol of the Republican Party in Minnesota. He's the governor. And he would like to be considered for 2012.
He was high on the John McCain list for running mates.
Maybe number two, three.
Right.
So all of a sudden he is seen at home as the symbol of the party that refuses to let the apparently elected and soon to be certified winner of the 2008 Senate election take his place in the Senate and represent the state. Most people in Minnesota seem to think that's going to blow back on the Republicans in the state. Maybe that doesn't concern John Cornyn, whose only real worry is the United States Senate. And I think a lot of national Republicans have written Minnesota off. They figure they're just not going to win a lot more elections there. Certainly not presidential elections. They don't worry about it that much. Think it's a just deep-dyed blue state. Goodbye.
Yeah, but that was a 50-50 Senate race.
Yes, and I do see their argument for wanting to count every ballot. But what I'm saying is, in Minnesota, when they get the sense that the National Republican Party is denying them having as many senators as the other 49 states, that's not going to do the GOP any good in the gopher state.
So we've already said that Sarah Palin has problems for 2012. It looks like Tim Pawlenty has problems. We've already in previous podcasts talked about the problems that Bobby Jindal had with his response to the State of the Union.
Bobby, Americans can do anything.
Can you say Mitt Romney?
Now, he's actually...
Mitt Romney won the straw poll at the CPAC convention. Meeting rather earlier this year and won it pretty easily, despite the fact that there was not a lot of obvious hoopla over him. Rush Limbaugh walked away with the hoopla. So I'm beginning to feel more and more as though Mitt Romney's to lose.
I think so. I think you and I have talked about this in the past. It reminds, some of these old-timers may understand this, but Richard Nixon in 1966, after his defeat in 60 for president, 62 for governor of California, he rebounded and became the party everywhere. Fundraisers, campaigning on behalf of candidates, raising money, things like that.
And he was everywhere helping them.
Right. And that could be Mitt Romney in 2012. I should tell you, though, that in my Political Junkie blog, there's still tremendous vituperation between the Ron Paul people and the Romney people. They apparently despise each other.
Now, why? Why is that? Well, does that make sense to you?
Well, one of it is I think they think he's a phony. I think a lot of conservatives say, well, you know, once upon a time, Mitt Romney was a pro-choice candidate when he ran against Ted Kennedy for the Senate, when he was elected governor of Massachusetts, and this late conversion was because he wants to be president.
Yes, but does that really explain the hostility and the friction with Ron Paul? Because Ron Paul's, after all, a libertarian. He doesn't care that much about the social issues. He's much more of a, you know, let's get back on the gold standard kind of conservative. My guess is that the Ron Paul people are focusing on Romney just because he's the emergent frontrunner. And I'll tell you who's not an emergent frontrunner in the Republican Party for 2012. Nobody seems to be talking anymore about Rudy Giuliani.
Well, he was once upon a time running for president of Florida.
Yes, and that did not work out
no,
so well for him. No, it was not the greatest strategy.
But he did reappear this week.
He did, in the 20th District of New York, which was really the news of the weekend, and we should have led with that except for one thing. We don't know who won.
Well, we were prepared to say that whoever wins this race, it's a big referendum on Barack Obama's economic policies. And here
you were prepared to say that.
Well, a lot of people were.
Everybody was prepared to say that. That seemed to be the big theme of the week. We were going to find out what America thought of Barack Obama in the Hudson Valley of New York.
And
State.
The reason everybody
I
agree with you. And the reason everybody was talking about New York 20 is because Kirsten Gillibrand was the congresswoman there who was plucked out of the House by David Paterson to become the new senator from New York after Hillary Clinton left.
Wow, that was a great sentence.
Thank you. So the two candidates in New York 20 were Scott Murphy, a venture capitalist, first-time candidate.
Long-time listener, first-time candidate.
I like that. Very good. And Jim Todisco, who is not a first-time candidate. He's been in the State Assembly for 29 years. He's the minority leader. And people know his name. I mean, you know, his music was a Todisco Inferno.
Todisco Inferno? That's why he lost.
Well, he didn't. He may not have lost.
He may not have lost. But you know what he didn't do, Ken? He didn't win.
Oh.
And if you don't win in a special election in a district that favors your party by 70,000 registrations,
which has been voting Democratic for since at least 2006.
It has had a Democratic congressperson for two elections and went for a Barack Obama 51-49. So, well,
it went for Kirsten Gillibrand
margin.
With 62%.
And there are only three Republican districts left in New York State.
Right, out of 29.
Out of 29. This is a Republican district. There's no way around it.
I am saying that
he should have won, especially in a special, because in a special election, Republicans turn out to vote normally much more often than Democrats.
Okay, look at it another way. All the polls had a clear trend towards Scott Murphy. Once upon a time, Todisco
he was down 10-some points.
Right, and then Murphy was gaining. It was within four. Then the last Siena College poll had Murphy up by four. Every political professional in Washington, which it may sound like a pejorative to some people, all thought that Murphy was going to win. I think both sides clearly have something to crow about in New York 20. I don't think it was a great Republican defeat at all. I don't. Ultimately, it'll be up to the absentee ballots. There are up to 10,000 absentee ballots.
Very hard to read that.
Right. That have to be counted by April 13th. Both the White House and the Republicans say that these absentees will favor them. I have spoken to some people who vacation up in that area, and they vote absentee, and they have told me that most of those people who do that are of the liberal persuasion. That could help Murphy.
But that could help Murphy. And in the end, if Murphy wins, he will be disproving my theory about Republican turnout in this one instance, at least. But it still seems to me that Republicans tend to turn out more often than Democrats. And if they've got a 70,000 registration advantage, then there needs to be an explanation coming from the other direction. And I think you've got several things that tend to do that.
I think there are a lot of people who still register Republicans in the Northeast, but they're just so sick of the GOP, the label, the policies. Everything.
And they often prefer the Democratic candidate.
Certainly in the last
couple
of cycles.
You bring up Connecticut, and that's interesting because it brings us back to polls and the limits of polls. There's a poll out this week from Quinnipiac, which is a pretty reputable polling operation associated with the university up there in Connecticut, and they have found that Chris Dodd has now slipped all the way down to 34%, choosing him for another term in the 2010 election, 50% choosing his opponent.
Well,
that's pretty
possible opponent,
stuff.
Former Congressman Rob Simmons. I mean,
pretty likely
other
opponent given polls like that.
I agree. But this is April of 2009 and not November of 2010.
A snapshot in time.
But the Quinnipiac person who talked about the poll said it's rare that an incumbent who's been in there for nearly 30 years in the Senate, Chris Dodd was first elected in the Senate in 1980, and of course his father was in the Senate before that, the fact that he's down to 34%, it's pretty remarkable for
somebody. That's a real drubbing. Yeah. That's a real drubbing. Now, I also think Chris Dodd's getting a little spanking from the voters back in Connecticut because he spent so much time running for president, moving his family to Iowa, all of that.
Yeah.
It seemed a bit of a vanity
episode.
It's
the AIG stuff that really is really...
I think it's the EGO stuff.
And who was the last Democratic senator from Connecticut to be defeated?
Okay, well, not a little Weicker. It's got to be an outright Democrat. Well, would it be Thomas Dodd, Chris Dodd's father?
Exactly.
Well, he was not actually expelled from the Senate. He was reprimanded.
And lost to Lowell Weicker in a three-way race in 1970. But it's interesting that Chris Dodd could follow his father. Of course, the situation is much different. His father was censured by the Senate for mis- handling personal finances, blah, 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 1967.
But not expelled. It was the voters who did him in.
That's right, 1970. But it would be interesting if 30 years later, the next Democrat senator to lose is his son.
Certainly an irony, given that Chris Dodd got into politics to clear the family name, to rescue the reputation of his father, and seemed to have done that over an extraordinarily successful career in the 70s running for Congress and then in the 80s and since.
I think we both agree, though, that it's a little too early to write his political obituary just yet.
He's a resourceful politician, and much can change in the next 18 months. That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
I know a spot, peaceful and fair. I'd be so happy if I were there. No matter where I chance to be, Connecticut is the place for me.
Miss every lake, miss every hill. Even in dreams I think of them still. And when you see them you'll agree, Connecticut is the place to be.
Village green, childhood scenes, I think.